Hello and welcome to the Slightly Fox podcast from Hoxton Square in East London. If you haven't joined us before, welcome. And as loyal listeners will know, this is a podcast about lost and lesser known books and the art of publishing. Well, small is beautiful here at Slightly Fox. The editorial team is tiny, but trust me when I say their literary knowledge is profound. Having said that, there is nothing snooty about this little magazine. It covers good writing of every sort. Now, last time we talked about biography with Adam Sisman. This time we're looking at bookshops and booksellers. My name is Philippa Lamb. Slightly Fox founder Gail Perkis is here as ever.
Good morning.
With Anna Kirk.
Hello.
And we have a rare visit from another founder, Stephanie Allen.
Good morning.
Now, you were telling me, Steph, just before we started recording, the bookshops are really key to little publishing houses like this.
Yes, bookshops are really our shop window. And we've had a lot of subscribers come to us through finding us in bookshops.
So you sell your books that you publish and republish. And of course, the Quarterly is
and
in
the
bookshops,
Quarterly,
isn't it?
Yes. And it's a very good partnership with a lot of independent bookshops.
And that's not just in the UK, is it now?
No, we have quite a few overseas bookshops.
It's a growing number, isn't it?
We really are trying to push the Quarterly and the books further afield. And we are always open to suggestions from readers and subscribers. Just mention us at local bookshops and we can certainly supply them.
I remember you mentioning, was it last time, a new one in Canada?
Yes, in Vancouver. And then we're also trying to explore bookshops in the Far East as well.
It's a happy thought, isn't it, that it travels far and wide? Before we go any further, don't worry if you hear noises off from the rest of the Slightly Fox team. They're all working away around us. We often have unscheduled interruptions from dogs. And I'm sorry to say, after a builder-free podcast last time, the builders are back today. I think I've already heard them drilling, so they may pop up. Apologies. It's all part of life's rich pattern here in Hoxton Square. Well, as I said, our theme today is bookshops and booksellers, and we have two very knowledgeable guests with us. Brett Wollstonecroft of Daunt Books in Marylebone in London, and Kathleen Smith of Toppings in that most elegant of cities, Bath in the West Country. We'll be discussing the history and the present-day art of selling books, and of course looking at how bookshops continue to flourish in the face of online competition. Our essay from the Slightly Fox archive this time is in the same vein. It's an extract from a piece by Mike Petty recalling his time as a young publisher back in the 70s and the horrors of visiting bookshops and dealing with authors. As always, we will have book recommendations later on. And right at the very end, our new appendix for all those listeners who asked for an audio section about how and where they can buy the books that we talk about every month. Let's start by getting up to date with what's going on here with the magazine and indeed the bookish world generally. Steph?
I've been thinking about literary festivals. A lot of our readers do go to literary festivals, but if you haven't been to one, they're great events. There are so many all over the country. A few favourites. There's the Idler magazine having a festival in July in Hampstead, North London.
In London?
Then there's the Langham Festival in Pembrokeshire, which is a gorgeous little festival, been going for about 3 years. And I think if you avoid some of the bigger festivals and look out for the small independents, you'll find, well, you won't have the crowds.
No.
You'll find a really interesting range of authors.
One of my favourites is the Way With Words, which happens down in Dartington in Devon. They have a few famous names, but they also have people who are less well-known, but genuinely very interesting and inspiring.
It's less of a commercial machine,
yes,
isn't
exactly.
It? Some of the big ones are colossal now, aren't they?
And don't forget that we have our own literary festival, which is a one-day festival we hold at the Art Workers Guild in Bloomsbury. It's the 2nd of November this year. We have some very exciting guests booked already. We've got Michael Palin.
Say that again. We have who?
Michael Palin.
That's impressive.
And Bart Van Ess, who won the Costa Award for The Cutout Girl and also won the Slightly Foxed Best First Biography Award this year.
There is a note here that we should make it that tickets are only for magazine subscribers, is that right?
Only for subscribers, and they will be on sale 15th of May.
Really? This very day?
This very day.
And
yes.
I should say, having been to it for the first time myself last year, it's a fantastic event, but it sells out really fast because it's a very little venue, isn't it?
It is. There's only 95 tickets. And in addition to some lovely speakers, we have some fabulous cakes every year for tea.
Ooh. That's quite a lineup, though.
Yes.
Well done, Steph. Anna?
Well, we have signed off on the summer issue now, so that will be printed up at Smith's Settle. We always try to have no wastage, so on the covers, we always use up as much of the paper as possible. So all of our bookmarks, if you receive our bookmarks, they will have been printed on the covers, and we'll also be printing some podcast postcards this time around.
Great, so they're offcuts.
Yes, so we don't have anything going to waste.
That's a really nice idea. Gail.
Yes, the summer issue is a particularly delicious one. We start off with an article about a pig man's annotated handbook, which is really about P.G. Woodhouse.
Okay.
And we have an Olympic bronze medalist writing about the book that inspired him to learn to sprint. A delicious article about Jane Austen and the infuriating way in which she describes property. In fact, the author describes her as an estate agent monkey.
I've never really thought
about that. And then a lot of other things too, including a wonderful novel by Cesare Pavese about fascism in Italy after the war. So the issue is full of really good things.
Interesting. Mix, remind me, when is it out?
It's out on the 1st of June.
Now, very unfortunately, Anna has got to leave, but appropriately enough, it's to, I think, you want to talk to a bookshop?
Yep, I will be packing up some bookshop orders ready to ship out.
We're going to see if we can drag her back for a book recommendation a bit later on, but for now, bye Anna. Let me welcome our guest now, Brett Wollstonecroft of Dawn Books in Marylebone.
Good morning.
And Kathleen Smith of Toppings in Bath.
Hello.
And Kathleen, you used to work at Slightly Foxed.
Yes, I was part of the team right at the beginning when we sat around Gail's table, and I was expecting our second son.
Because I think we made mention of your baby, or one of your babies, in an earlier podcast, Baby Under the Kitchen
baby
Table
was
in
born.
The early
the baby's
days.
Baby's now 15. Steph did publicity, I did the sales bit, you know, phoning bookshops, making sure we were stocked in good independence.
Yeah. And now bookseller.
Gone back to the other side now.
You have. We're going to put pictures of your bookshops on the website because, as people will see, you both have really beautiful bookshops in very beautiful locations. I have to admit a bit of bias here, actually, that Dawn's, yours, Brett, was my local bookshop for many years.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful bookshop. I think it was one of our great discoveries was this wonderful Edwardian bookshop, galleried bookshop with a great long skylight, beautiful oak shelves everywhere, which was empty and derelict and, in fact, about to be dismantled the moment that we found it back in 89. Best decision we, or certainly James Dawn, ever made, I think, was picking that building in what appeared to be a quiet, rundown backwater of London. Very, very different now.
That bookshop's been called the most beautiful in the world, hasn't it? And actually, it's a fair comment. It's a gorgeous shop.
It's a beautiful shop. I think there are a number of other bookshops that would have a claim to that, but it's a wonderful building, and I think having worked in it all these years, you realise how well designed it was.
Because it was an antiquarian bookshop, wasn't it? I can remember going at Francis Edwards.
Francis Edwards and then Tooley Adams, who were a sort of, I think, conglomerate of independent booksellers. And then it was vacant for a couple of years with sort of leather-bound books lying on the floor, a lot of rubble, and this beautiful light coming into it, which was what you saw through a closed grate back at the end of the 80s.
And we should say travel books.
The idea originally was to arrange the shop by country. It was the arrangement of the shop and finding different ways of seeing books. It was because we had been frustrated in those days, if you wanted to go travelling, finding a book set in a place and perhaps something about the cookery there and perhaps something about the Prime Minister and a biography and all those things that I think you want as a cultural sense of a place, you could either not find it or you had to go everywhere in a bookshop. And we wanted just to see how that worked on a shelf, and happily it worked very well.
Yeah, and Kathleen, Toppings is in Bath, of course, so you have just a World Heritage Site as a backdrop. For overseas listeners who maybe don't know Bath, think neoclassical crescents and pretty well every Jane Austen film you've ever seen, really, isn't it? How long have you been open there?
Our bookshop is 12. We're in our 12th year. And, I mean, the one thing that people do say, they walk in, and I think it's beautiful, but it isn't in such a beautiful building. But it's very, very long and very thin, and we have these very tall library ladders that go all the way up to the ceiling. Beautiful lighting, which we've invested in the last couple of years. So our shelves go from floor right up to ceiling, and we encourage people to climb up. And it looks like a very tiny bookshop from the outside, but goes all the way back and up into the most beautiful art room that houses one of the biggest art art book sections outside London.
So, with such a Aladdin's Cave feel opening up, I think.
All the best bookshops are, aren't they? They have hidden rooms and extra staircases.
Well, we have a door that's a bookshelf, which children absolutely love.
I'd absolutely love that. Yeah. So Steph was saying to me earlier that bookshops aren't like other shops, are they? They're intimate places.
Yes, I don't know quite what it is, but there's a romance about bookshops. Maybe it's because they're very creative places. I think they're often seen as the hub of a community. They're just different. I think other shops arrive around them.
Mm. Yes.
They can reinvigorate a high street.
Yeah. I think it's partly because bookshops are actually a window on the world. I mean, if you go into a bookshop, you can reach through reading the entire world.
And they're an escape, aren't they? Because you walk into a bookshop, you don't have to go into a bookshop. It's not like a butcher's or a baker's. You're already in a more mellow mindset, aren't you, when you walk into a bookshop?
Yes, and receptive to new ideas and to exploration.
I think there's also something which is, for some reason, they allow the customers to get a very strong sense of ownership themselves. They feel this is their shop. I mean, you must have this too. I think people very quickly get a sense of proprietorial sort of feel about the space. It's not just your shop, it's their shop. That becomes a very powerful sort of cultural glue, I think, in any town.
Lots of movies, of course, now I come to think about it. 84 Charing Cross Road.
Penelope Fitzgerald, the bookshop.
Notting Hill. Mm.
Notting Hill, and when Harry met Sally, they meet up again in a bookshop. Little bit of frisson.
We have regulars who have been coming since we opened. One thing we do is make coffee for customers, for readers, and it's all on the house. It's a tray of, you know, cafetiere coffee or a pot of tea. And there are people who come in every week. There's one particular older gentleman, he comes in every Wednesday and has been coming in for the last 12 years. So we're a little sanctuary, I suppose.
That's more and more important in a busier world. That sense of sanctuary is you know, as strong in a bookshop, perhaps, as it is in some churches. When you do find, I mean, people coming up to you saying, 10 years ago, I don't even remember me, I used to come in a lot. I was in the middle of a terrible divorce and you kept me sane. Mm, you do play
that
kind of role in people's lives.
We're saying how lovely bookshops are, but there has been a huge decline, certainly in this country and elsewhere. Mm. Yeah. Is it all about online?
I don't think so. Not anymore.
No, the big cull of bookshops is roughly sort of 2005 to 2015. Independence, you go from about 1,600 down to 600.
It's amazing.
It's devastating.
I'm just a slaughterhouse. Change. They closed everywhere, didn't they?
But I don't think all of that was down to the internet. The carnage from the internet is a bit later. It's 2010, 12 onwards. Some of it is simply high street rents, rates, all of those things. And some of it is the fact that some of those were poor shops, dare I say. Some of the poorer ones, when Waterstone started to change book selling in its first incarnation under Tim Waterstone, were frankly not up to the scratch that those early Waterstone's shops were. And then you had supermarkets, of course, and then you had the end of the net book agreement, all these things, sort of perfect storm.
I was a young bookseller in those days, and we were all employed for our passion and our energy and our specialist knowledge. And it was filled with bookselling was filled with really interesting people.
Yes,
there were artists and musicians and writers.
Yeah.
And you ran your own sections, so you curated your own little sections in the bookshops. You sold your books, and that's the part of the job that gives you the most pleasure, I think.
Well, that brings us to James Daunt rather neatly, doesn't it?
Obviously, what's happened with Waterstones, I think, is in many ways a return to that era where chain bookselling can be as exciting and interesting and reflective of its local community as independence. It's perhaps no more than taking the independent ethos and putting that into chain bookselling.
Because James owns your own chain, doesn't he, Daunts?
He owns the shop. These days has nothing to do with running it.
Yeah.
But of course.
So you and he founded the whole idea?
He certainly founded it. I really, at that time, thought I wanted to be a lawyer, but we'd been at university together. Mm-hmm. So as you do when you set up a small business, you need everybody you know really to help. We had Hugh Bonneville later, Downton Abbey fame. So really everybody. And I stayed because I loved it.
And there are nine, is that right, in the chain?
So we have nine. They're not all called Daunt Books.
And James took that ethos to Waterstones.
Yes, I think Tuk,
where
Tuk
he's MD. Is that right?
Yeah, he's been the managing director under two owners now since then, and that was on the brink. I think people still don't realise how close Waterstones was to collapse with all the issues that that would have brought, and it needed somebody, I think, with a very different vision, who wasn't just someone parachuted in who had previously sold shoes or baked beans.
And he, to my consumer eye, brought what you were talking about, Kathleen, that sense of giving people in the shops control over their areas so they could recommend books. Because I think there was an idea that all those recommended reads, was it head office recommending them all, or was it people in the shops? So,
I mean, I haven't got the figure in my head, but the figure for what Waterstones was being paid by publishers up front in 2010 when you took over, which drove where you put books and what you put in windows, it's an enormous proportion of what Waterstones was taking. That relationship had to change before you can make bookshops feel more like independents, because that's what we do as independents, is we just go on what we love and enjoy.
Because presumably if you have those big commercial relationships, it's the same across the world, so all your bookshops look
the
same.
Have to have the book.
Presumably, Kathleen, that's not going to work.
There was a core stock, and there was a sort of A list and a B list.
Yeah. And there was a thing called a planogram. I don't know whether you remember planograms, but
probably
Waterstones had a thing where essentially you had a photograph of what a particular section of the shop shelves should look like.
That's exactly what supermarkets do, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. And that went to all the shops.
Yeah, so this was bookshops trying to follow big commercial models from other sectors, and clearly it didn't work. So it's the trend is reversing now. Because, Kathleen, your shops, you've got, how many is it?
Soon to be four. Robert and Louise Topping decided to settle up in St Andrews in Scotland. It was the most natural thing to open a bookshop there. And that has a wood-burning stove, lots of lovely Turkish carpets and sofas and lovely, lovely bookshop. Just recently, we've announced Edinburgh. And to open, we think, in the summer. It's a lovely building. It's on two floors, former bank, lots of windows, and it will be the biggest independent general bookshop.
Yeah. Fascinating.
That's big.
So bigger than Hatchard's?
Yes.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Your shops are very different in character, I'm thinking, depending on where they are.
They are different but similar. You know, we have the same ethos, hand-built shelf, the knowledgeable booksellers, the range of stock. You know, we tend not to specialise, and I think that helps. So they're large, and there's something for everyone.
But in terms of choosing stock for your audience in a location, how do you do that?
It really comes down to having wonderful booksellers, because good bookshops simply reflect the communities that they're in. You never decide what you're going to put there and what you're going to sell. You listen to people and react to that. If you're a bookseller, you're reading an awful lot, but tuning in to what people want is the essence of all bookselling, all good bookselling anyway.
What about events?
Well, we do lots.
Absolutely vital. The range of events that you have down in Bath is exceptional. I think we look sometimes at your events and think, how on earth can you keep up such a programme?
What sort of things?
But all of us do.
It's the festival that never stops. Yeah. It's completely rolling. I will go back tomorrow and do a vegan cookery evening. On Monday, we had a wonderful Mexican novelist. We had sort of 60 to 70 people. Tuesday night was Stuart Barnes, the voice of rugby union. Oh, so diverse, so diverse.
Say, it's a rolling
Another
program,
teeny weeny little literary fiction event with Joanna Walsh on Wednesday.
I think it's something that we all do. I mean, we do one a week, and then we had a festival last week, which is over 2 days, and it's quite intense. But I think bookshops have to do this now. You have to be very much at the heart of a community culturally. It brings authors in. It brings new customers into the shops. It's absolutely central to what we do. We do book launches as well. But I don't think it's very easy for small independents who haven't got the space to do events to survive. This is a core part of good bookshops now.
It's a lot of work. Does it sell you more books?
Yes.
Doing the events is a way of bringing people to the bookshop. People that often wouldn't otherwise come to a bookshop. So if you have the singer-songwriter Tracy Thorne has written her third book, it's called Another Planet, and it's being a teenager in 1970s suburbia. So we will do these bigger events for 300 people in churches close by in order to bring that audience, you know, to the bookshop.
And I think it ties authors in too. Authors want to support bookshops. but they're not always aware of you. Once an author's come to do an event, they'll come back and sign, they will talk about your bookshop on social media.
They want the indies to survive, and they're not just in the business of shoveling out books online.
And I think important, you know, not just in sales of the books at that event, but it raises the profile. I mean, I'm often saying to an author, if you do an event, you might sell 20, 30 copies on that particular night, but you will sell 50% more in the preceding 3 weeks and the 3 weeks after and throughout the year.
Oh, is that how it works?
It's ongoing.
It's an endorsement by a good bookshop, and it matters.
Who buys the most books? Do you analyse your demographic?
I'm not sure there is a typical customer. There are areas where, as in with children's books particularly, you're finding parents now buying an awful lot more books than I think would have been typical.
Is that about library closures?
It's got a lot to do with library closures.
Yeah. So parents bring their children in to encourage the habit and buy.
And children coming in to spend their vouchers, that period after Christmas time is usually still buoyant for us anyway.
All those book tokens from aunts.
And I think parents want their children to escape the digital world, don't they?
I think what I would say, just that I've noticed in 30 years I've been doing it, is that people will buy more than one book. That's a more typical purchase when they're in a bookshop than the single book that you went specifically into a shop to buy.
Yes, I do that. It's quite normal. Does anyone else do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I've got shelves and shelves of books I bought with the intention of reading them.
And we'll read them one day.
If you come for a particular event, you're often buying the book in question. But if that occasion is happening in the bookshop, people invariably will go around and browse the shelves and come with a big pile of books. That's lovely.
You all sound quite optimistic about the future.
Well, I think we've just had 2 years where more bookshops have opened than closed for the first time in 10, 15, 20 years. It has been looking very healthy.
It's not easy. It's tough. Tough old world out there still when people are a click away from.
It's so easy to buy online,
I think as well, I think what we probably would all say is that publishers have moved our way. This improvement in the physical book is absolutely vital to bookshops like ourselves.
Books as beautiful objects.
We've really got something now we can do something with, and that wasn't the case 20 years ago.
And Brett, is it right that people ask to get married in your bookshop?
They ask to get married, and they also ask if they can propose quite regularly. We get requests from people who want to secrete a ring in a book, and then the unsuspecting partner will come in and say, I gather there's a book here for me, and there'll be a ring hidden away in the book. So yes, the whole time.
With the romance in bookshops, didn't you meet your husband in Waterstones, Manchester?
Is that true?
We were both working for Robert Toppy at the big Waterstones in Manchester on Deansgate. James was the poetry buyer. I was the publicity and marketing manager, and yes, I used to make him carry 200 chairs up to the top. You know, he was the chair boy and the poetry. He was a part-time poetry buyer, and he was doing his MA.
That is so delightful. It's brought us very neatly full circle. I love that story. We'll have book recommendations from everyone in a bit, but first, let's hear this month's piece from the Slightly Foxed archive, and this time it's an extract from a piece written by Mike Petty, recalling his time as a young publisher back in the 1970s.
It was the custom then, in the late 70s, and still is for all I know, for editors to saunter forth from their ivory towers and visit bookshops with the reps, experience life at the sharp end of the book trade and so on. It was called being on the road, but tended to concentrate on large centres of population easily reached from London. On this occasion, I was in Edinburgh, doing the rounds of Thins, Baumeister's and other shops no doubt long gone. Some months before, I had commissioned a rather opportunistic anthology of dirty verse to be edited by a Scots poet and litterateur of some notoriety. We had never met, so it seemed a good idea to join him for a drink on his home patch. At the appointed hour, 6 p.m, I turned up at a pub off the Royal Mile. I had no idea what my poet looked like, but a quick scan of the crowded bar told me that he was the gravel-voiced party with scrubby beard and pink eyes. I was right. "The grouse," he growled when I asked him what he'd like. Instinct told me that he meant a double, and I was right about that too. It seemed convenient to join him. I no longer remember what we talked about for the next hour or two. I suppose the anthology must have featured, and I dare say the iniquities of publishers made an appearance. I was beginning to think longingly of my hotel room when he suddenly said, "We'll eat." Parked in the narrow street was a small car. Behind the wheel sat a woman, while in the back seat was a small, furious girl of about 12. He slumped into the front seat and waved us into motion. I had just met the poet's wife and daughter. They had been waiting outside in the car for several hours. The daughter was on her way home from a school camping trip and was whimpering with exhaustion. I knew that the poet lived across the Forth Bridge in Fife, and it gradually dawned on me that across the Forth Bridge was where we were heading. Frantically, I offered dinner for all four of us anywhere, absolutely anywhere, as long as it was within tottering distance of the Royal Mile. Apparently, this was out of the question because the daughter had to be got home to bed. I sympathised entirely. A grunt from the front seat brought us to a halt. The poet strode into a Chinese takeaway and, without reference to the menu or me, gritted out a series of numbers. I paid the bill. It seemed to be expected. It turned out that the 20 minutes or so we had to wait for our order would most fruitfully be spent in the pub next door. More grouse was ordered. Suddenly, the poet was in a fight, the ripples of which spread out to where I tiptoed drunkenly but delicately around the edges, feeling more effete and metropolitan than ever in my publisher's corduroys. It was over as soon as it had begun, and we were back in the small car, clutching bags of Chinese food. More driving along ever-narrowing roads brought us to a long driveway and a small lodge-like building with a solid door. The females went through it without a word and disappeared, leaving the poet to lead me to the kitchen. It must have been after 11, and I was very drunk. The poet produced homemade wine of a wild and fruity nature. I started casting around for somewhere to sleep. A sofa in the sitting room seemed the best bet, and it was then that I made yet another mistake. I can rarely pass a piano without sitting down and playing, particularly when drunk. I was modulating sensitively into something I had resolved to call pissed poet blues when the man himself burst into the room in a towering rage. It turned out that my crime was not just playing the piano, but playing it properly. Better than him, me with my fancy London ways. A few more curses and he was gone, leaving me to sleep the sleep of the drunk on the sofa. I woke at 6, my head and bowels roaring in unison, still dressed in rumpled and by now stained corduroys. I let myself out, and help arrived in the shape of the postman in his van. "You'll be wanting to get to Edinburgh," he said without emotion. The poet and I never met again. He wrote me a long letter full of hand-wringing and self-loathing. He had never behaved like that before, apparently. I caught sight of him a few years later on a TV discussion programme, roaring and waving his arms about as if someone had had the effrontery to play the piano without consulting him. When he died some years ago, the obituaries made mention of feuds and schisms in the Scots poetry world, and it was not hard to see how they might have arisen.
That was an extract from a piece called Up There on a Visit, written by Mike Petty and published in Slightly Fox issue number 8, read for us by Andrew Hawkins. What a monster.
Yes, I don't think we can mention any difficult authors on air, can we?
Obviously not. It
brings back memories of a few author tours when we were at John Murray's.
They could be a tricky bunch.
Sometimes, yes.
Moving swiftly on. Elegant and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but disappear from bookshops. Its contributors are established writers, journalists, and people from many fields. They all share their passion for particular books and authors, and since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? Happily, it's a bargain. £48 for a year's print subscription and free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com. Or if you'd rather talk to a human, give Hattie a call. She's on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Book recommendations, and I'm going to call Anna back to the table.
I thought I'd take this opportunity to recommend some books about bookshops, especially titles that pick up on the eccentricities of bookshop life. So Diary of a Bookseller by Sean Bithell. Weird Things Customers Say in Bookshops by Jen Campbell is particularly entertaining. One of our previous Slightly Foxed editions, 84 Charing Cross Road, which we'll actually be bringing out in a plain Foxed edition later this year too.
Oh, perfect. That's an excellent idea. Thanks for that, Anna. Kathleen?
The one that I recommend all the time in the bookshop is a Canadian writer called Miriam Taves. Has anyone heard of her?
No.
No, and it's a novel, one of her novels called All My Puny Sorrows, which I think is a line from a Coleridge poem. I recommend it when people just want something to read and they want something that is surprising and rare. And it's the story of two sisters set in the Canadian Mennonite community, which it doesn't matter where it's set, but it just happens to be set in that community. Two sisters, Elf, who is extremely talented concert pianist, desperately trying to kill herself, and her sister Yolly, who lives a kind of altogether happier but messier life. She sleeps with the wrong men, and she's desperately trying to keep her sister together. It's so funny, heartwarming, redemptive writing. It's a tragedy. It's a tragicomedy, I guess, but it's uplifting, beautiful prose, and it goes down very well.
Fantastic. Thank you. Brett?
Well, I think nothing desperate original for me, but I reread every year Patrick O'Brien, which I know has huge numbers of followers. What I love about it is not the ships and the cannons and the fighting, but as a portrait of a friendship, I think it's almost unequalled in British English literature. And it's that I return to, the humour and the friendship. You could pick any one. Master and Commander is the first of them. I don't think the relationship is really established in that book.
There's 20 of them?
Yes, about that. Yes. And of varying quality, if one's absolutely honest.
Do you have a particular favourite?
The Far Side of the World, which is I think the one where all the elements are there, from the sort of natural history and the action and the friendship, absolutely at its consummate best. So I love O'Brien for that. And if I can just mention the thing I'm reading at the moment, or just finish reading, Andrew Miller's Now We Should Be Entirely Free, for the main reason that it hasn't been mentioned in any of the literary prizes. Booksellers always complain about this, why wasn't this on a shortlist or a long list? But that's an astonishing omission to me. It's a wonderful novel. At the heart of it is a chase. It goes all the way up to the Hebrides. It's beautifully written, and certainly the best novel I've read in the past couple of years.
And the name again?
Now We Should Be Entirely Free.
Steph?
At the moment, I'm reading Angela Carter. I quite often like to read two books from an author, because then I think you get the full sense. So I've just finished The Magic Toy Shop, which is an early novel of hers. It's fantastical, very sensual, very strange. But I think I actually preferred The Bloody Chamber. They're her fairy tales for adults. Dark, sensual, and again, very strange, but they really stay in your memory. And I think actually with The Bloody Chamber, it's quite good to read one and then read something else and then go back to the stories, because they're almost too rich together. A very rich box of chocolates.
As always, a very diverse list of recommendations. Thank you very much. And thank you to Kathleen Smith and to Brett Wollstonecroft for being with us today. We've loved having you. Thank
pleasure.
You.
Pleasure. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe so that each episode pops onto your smartphone or your tablet on the 15th day of every month. If you have time, we would love you to rate and review the series on your podcast app too. Remember the new appendix right at the very end of the podcast. That's the one with details on how and where to buy all the books we've talked about and how to subscribe to the Quarterly magazine. If you would rather read all that than listen, you can find it all on the show notes attached to the episode, or indeed on the website. That's foxedquarterly.com. We will be back on the 15th of June with a podcast about travel writing. Thanks for listening. And here's the appendix for episode 7. If you'd like to get in touch, visit the website www.foxedquarterly.com. The email address is office@foxquarterly.com. You can phone on 020 7033 0258 or you can write to 53 Hoxton Square, London N16PB. If you'd like to make a purchase, copies of the current issue, all the back issues and in-print books are all available in the Slightly Foxed online shop and good bookshops all around the UK and overseas. You can find a full list on the website foxedquarterly.com/stockists. If your local bookshop doesn't yet stock the magazine or the books, they can order them in for you. Just ask them to contact Anna in the Slightly Foxed office. Single issues of the magazine, as well as books, goods and subscriptions, can be shipped worldwide. If you subscribe to the Quarterly, you'll receive more than 4 beautifully produced printed issues of the magazine each year. Subscribers also receive a host of other benefits, such as early booking for events, preferential prices for books and goods, access to the full digital archive of all the back issues, the Quarterly Readers Catalogue, offers from Slightly Foxed partner organisations, that's bookshops and festivals such as the Royal Society of Literature, Gladstone's Library, independent bookshops and reading retreats, and much more besides. If you'd like to make a gift, the first issue can be wrapped in the signature Slightly Foxed brown paper and cream ribbon and sent out with a handwritten gift card in time for a date of your choosing. Subscriptions start at £48, including UK postage for the year, with a special 10% discount for readers aged under 30. You can find a full range of subscriptions at foxquarterly.com/subscribe. And here are details of all the Slightly Foxed books, goods and events that we mentioned in this episode. The Slightly Foxed 2019 Reader's Day will be held on Saturday, 2nd of November at the Art Workers Guild in Bloomsbury in London. Tickets are now available to Slightly Foxed magazine subscribers only, £60 for a day ticket. Slightly Foxed issue 62 will be published on the 1st of June. It's now available to pre-order on the website as a single issue from £12, or you can choose to begin a subscription with this issue. Mike Petty's article, entitled Up There on a Visit, was published in issue number 8, which you can buy as a single issue for £13 if you're a subscriber and £14 if you're not. Maggie Ferguson's article on 84 Charing Cross Road by Helena Hanf was published in issue 48. A plain foxed edition of 84 Charing Cross Road will be published in September. Grant McIntyre's 3 articles on Patrick O'Brien's Aubrey Maturin novels were published in issues 40, 41 and 42. Buy a set of any 4 single issues and you'll save £1 per issue. For anything else, please visit the show notes. They list all the other issues, books, goods and events that we mentioned in this episode, along with other useful information. You can find them on the Slightly Foxed website. And finally, the full essay reading from this episode is also available to Slightly Foxed magazine subscribers only on the website. Please note you will need to log in to view this content. Here's the address, foxquarterly.com/pod. Opening music. Preludio from Violin Partita No. 3 in E major by Bach. The reading music was Roads That Burned Our Boots by Jazar, shared under a Creative Commons license 3.0 via freemusicarchive.org. No changes were made. The sound effects were provided by freesfx.co.uk. Thank you.